Finally, this hour, we return to the hidden world of girls, our series produced with the Kitchen Sisters. The end of high school and the beginning of college is a momentous time for any teenager, a time of shifting identities and evolving family relationships. Well, now imagine going through all of that in a foreign country. 19-year-old Mandy Liu did just that.
Well, after 13 hours of arduous journey, I am finally in Beijing, and it feels kind of weird.
That was me a couple months ago, on my first trip back to China since before I started college in the U.S. It's been 2 years. When I saw my parents and grandmother at the airport, I felt awkward. I didn't really know what to say to them. The first thing my mother says to me is, "You're not fat." She always tells me I've gained weight when I talk to her over Skype. Whenever I cross the border between my two worlds, for the first few days, I feel like I'm in a daze. I have to find an identity for myself in a place that's so familiar and yet not familiar at all. And I'm all on my own whenever that happens, because no one around me knows my other world, or the kind of person I am in my other world. My parents are from northeastern China. They're migrant workers living in Beijing. Financially, they're not very stable. They run a traditional medicine shop doing acupuncture and massage. They work 7 days a week. I look at how hard their lives are, and I feel guilty that I can't help. It's hard for them to get a grip on what things are like for me. I don't think they know enough about America to have the capacity to understand certain things, like how I don't eat steamed buns for breakfast at school, or how I could disagree with my professor, or why a dance party at college where everybody cross-dresses is fun. So we end up talking about mundane subjects like what I want to eat for lunch. That day was kung pao chicken. On my trip back home, I spent a lot of time sitting around with family, eating or just snacking on sunflower seeds. My parents think it's important for me to connect with my relatives, but I have almost nothing to say. Sometimes I wonder if I'm actually related to them. As they got louder and louder, I would have flashbacks to the racket my friends and I would make in the school cafeteria over, you know, someone's silly trick with a straw. Or the racket we'd make with test tubes and beakers in the chemistry lab. I found myself missing that. I've been back from my visit to China for 2 months now. I'm still debating if I should put pictures from my trip on Facebook. Here in the U.S., I've been unconsciously only putting my American self out there. Maybe I'm afraid to show my differences, or maybe I'm simply avoiding the many questions I know will come my way.
That's Mandy Liu. Next week, she begins her sophomore year at Guilford College in Greensboro, North Carolina. We've been hearing a lot of bad financial news. There's the U.S. credit downgrade, trouble in the European economy, then down, then up, then down again markets, and all that in turn has a direct effect on what people do or do not do with their money. NPR Sonari Glinton reports on how the coverage of the markets affects the markets and your brain, and eventually your portfolio.
It's been hard to avoid all the scary financial news. Really, really hard.
This is a big, big psychological thing that's just happened.
Panic selling on Monday, causing U.S. markets to take a big plunge.
The economy stinks. Unemployment's above 9%.
It's as if the world's largest economy was walking around with a broken leg and two broken arms, and then someone came along and punched it in the nose.
All that news has an impact, not just financially, but even physically. All I had to do was walk outside my office to test that theory. Didn't have to go far. James and Anna Marie Conley were feeling the markets.
Oh, financial news. Oh, that makes me feel horrible. Horrible. The last week has been just painful.
I got sick for the first time in 14 years.
When we find information that induces anxiety and fear in us, this does change the way we think about our financial decisions.
Camelia Kunin is a professor at Northwestern University. She has two fields of study. One is corporate finance.
And the other one is on neuroeconomics or neurofinance.
Okay, you're going to have to tell me what neurofinance or neuroeconomics is.
What we're trying to do in this area is to use knowledge from neuroscience and psychology to understand how people think about financial risk and reward, how they think about forming their portfolios, and how they make economic choices in general.
Kunin says when we hear bad financial news, we become more risk-averse. For instance, if the stock market is tanking, we're more likely to buy bonds than stocks, even if that's the wrong thing to do. The way we hear the news affects us also.
When we're presented news in this very emotional way, very bombastic way, it's in our nature to pay more attention to it.
Not only do we pay more attention to the emotional bad news, but the more recent the news, the more it affects our decision making. Kunin says this is not the time to be making financial decisions.
I'm trying to tell people to just chill out. They should calm down. They should really just sit down and understand what is new today.
She says if nothing is new or different, don't do anything. Don't buy into the massive freakout. But is it even possible for us to take a collective chill pill? Adam Galinsky is one of Professor Kunin's colleagues at Northwestern. He says freaking out is kind of built into us.
I think probably one of the most fundamental laws of human nature that's enduring across all cultures is that, and in fact is probably true across species too, is that losses are more painful than gains are pleasurable.
It's about survival. It's more important for our survival to avoid the bad than seek the good. Let's imagine we're prehistoric hunters and gatherers and we come across a group of dancing people.
If you go into the field and dance, you get a little bit of pleasure for that day. If you don't follow the herd as they're running away from a tiger, you get eaten and your life is over.
So in that way, panicking is good. You don't get eaten by a tiger. Fast forward to modern times, most of our bad information isn't so cut and dry. It's surrounded by uncertainty.
When we find ourselves in uncertain situations, we look to see how other people are responding. We see them freak out. That makes us freak out more. They freak out more because they're looking at us. And we get the situation where you get a collective freak out.
Now add the news media to the freak out.
They're like a nuclear bomb. The technology is advanced that they can make these things move so much more quickly and so much more faster than they would have otherwise.
Am I making it worse by doing this story?
I mean, I think it could make things better, but it could also make things worse. It could make things better by providing perspective.
And Galinsky says it could make things worse by focusing on the scary information that caused the freak out in the first place. Sonari Glinton, NPR News.
Who likes the company of mean people, people who lie, cheat, steal? Well, author Ben Dolnick does, at least in fiction. For our series 3 books, he has this essay about 3 depraved, reprehensible protagonists. They are his absolute favorites.
People often talk about the characters in books as if they were considering who to invite to a dinner party. Oh, I just hated her. She was so mean. He's a bully. I didn't like how he treated his mother. There's something to be said for a likable character, but great fiction has a way of upending our ordinary standards. In life, we like tranquility. In books, we love tension. And in these 3 books, you'll find protagonists who you'd hate to meet in real life. You'd change train cars to get away from any of them, but who you'll love on the page. Philip Roth has made a cottage industry of unlikable characters. But compared to Mickey Sabbath, the furious and profane protagonist of Sabbath's Theater, Roth's earlier creations seem like Winnie the Pooh. Sabbath is an aging puppeteer, reeling from the death of his mistress, ablaze with hatred for just about everyone, as he barrels through the stages of grief, stealing from his friends, lusting after his students. You'll wonder if there's anything good about him at all. But Roth's fictional machinery has never run at such an astonishing clip. The book is a ferocious delight. Legend has it that Malcolm Lowry's friends kept suitcases next to their doors, so they could pretend to be leaving town if he came by wanting to stay over. By the time you've finished this brilliant semi-autobiographical novel, you'll understand why. Under the Volcano tells the story of an alcoholic British consul, Jeffrey Furman, drinking himself to death in southern Mexico. Hovering blurrily in his vicinity as he stumbles from bar to bar, the book evokes drunkenness better than anything I've ever read, are a half-brother and an ex-wife who may or may not be betraying him. Furman is an inveterate liar and a hopeless case, and his exploits might be too depressing to bear if Lowry didn't describe them so gorgeously. The book is dense with scenes that would be miserable to live through. Furman's lonely, drunken ride on a Ferris wheel comes to mind, but that are pure pleasure to read. Arno Strine, the narrator of Nicholson Baker's The Fermata, is someone you might report to the police if you encountered him on the street. Since he was a child, Strine has had the mysterious ability to pause time at will. You might imagine that he'd use this power to stop crimes or to learn French, but Strine, who's at least self-aware enough to lament his lack of virtue, is much more interested in undressing and caressing female strangers. You'll cringe, but you won't stop reading. These books may leave you craving a confessional, or at least craving the polite prose of P.G. Wodehouse, but they may also leave you thinking about just how different are our demands when it comes to reality and art. Disaster, depravity, disgrace. Ah, yes, just a few more minutes, and then you'll put down the book. Back to planning your dinner party, which, with any luck, will resemble fiction hardly at all.
That's Ben Dolnick for our series Three Books, in which authors tell us about books they love. Dolnick is the author of You Know Who You Are, and you can find more details about his reading recommendations, along with picks from a long list of other writers, on the Summer Books page of our website, npr.org.
Alexandra Fuller caught the world's attention with her first book, a best-selling memoir of growing up in Africa called Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight. It looked back on 1970s Rhodesia, the country now known as Zimbabwe, when white farmers were fighting a war against black rebels. It was a harsh and even tragic life where her parents lived through the deaths of three of their five young children. In that first book, Fuller's mother came across as a charismatic but troubled woman who drank too much and had a casual approach to mothering. Perhaps not surprising, Nicola Fuller always called it the awful book. In her new memoir, Alexandra Fuller looked further back to her mother's young life, an idyllic childhood in colonial Kenya, which produced a beautiful young woman, a madcap adventuress with a predilection for drama. It's called Cocktail Hour Under the Tree of Forgetfulness.
First of all, as my mother said, we don't really have cocktail hour, we have cocktail days. And often stories would start with, well, there was rather a lot to drink, I seem to remember. And then this sort of tale of chaos and madness and hilarity ensues.
Alexandra Fuller says in writing this memoir, she discovered a mother she never knew, the person her mother saw herself to be, a character of high romance.
She, at some point, must have looked around and decided that all her literary heroines, Beryl Markham and Isaac Dinesen, had flown aeroplanes and that this was something she did not have in her repertoire and that therefore her biography was incomplete. So she signed herself up with this charlatan flying instructor and taught herself to fly.
As you describe it, as she's flying this little plane, you can hear in the radio back on the ground her singing.
She was singing, "Fly Me to the Moon."
You know, there's a moment that seems to sum up the funny side of her eccentricity, even though you are, as a child, often the victim of it. When you and your older sister, Vanessa, she dressed you up for a kids' costume party. Tell us about that.
So mother's fancy dress parties were always hell, and she had endured these awful fancy dress parties as a child. I think it must be a peculiarly colonial form of entertainment to slap your kids up in these awful, hot, inappropriate, itchy costumes and, you know, make them parade around in the baking sun. And so having learned nothing from her childhood, my mother forced ever more killingly imaginative costumes on my sister and I. And the worst possible one was she decided to dress my older sister Vanessa up as a rose. And then she dressed me up as, quote, "I never promised you a rose garden," in an insecticide drum.
Right. Now, wait, your sister is in a tutu, pink little ribbons, very pretty, very girly thing. And you're in a...
I'm in an insecticide drum, yeah.
And a drum that had insecticide still in it a bit, I mean, on the inside, right?
Right, it was that incredibly toxic insecticide that you dust young tobacco seedlings with.
Why don't you read a little bit about that moment?
Mum explained that when she was in labour with me in England, the radio was playing I Never Promised You a Rose Garden, which was prophetic because when I arrived, I really was, as promised, not a rose garden. Mum has refused to waver from the story, even though I've since discovered the song became a hit a full year and a half after I was born and therefore could not have been playing when she was in labour with me. She had yellow skin and black hair, that's why we call her Bobo, Mum explained, because she looked just like a little baboon.
And your mother just proceeded apace.
Yes.
She didn't apologize. I mean, she didn't say, oh, sorry, dear, I didn't want to hurt your feelings, right?
You know, I think that one of the things about being raised British in Africa was you got this double whammy of toughness, because the sort of continent and place itself made you quite tough. And then you've got this British mother whose entire being rejects quote-unquote coddling in case it makes you too soft. So there's absolutely nothing standing between you and a fairly rough experience.
Well, your book does tell a tale of a sometimes quite dangerous and cruel world that you inhabited as a child. And part of that time was in a country at war, a war of liberation, rebels in Rhodesia trying to bring about a majority or black rule. But your mother and father were part of a colonial layer who felt they belonged there.
Correct.
Give us an example of what that really meant.
By the time the war was getting towards the end in the late 1970s, there were landmines frequently on the roads near where our farm was. The attacks on farmers were ratcheting up. So my parents didn't want us being on the roads unnecessarily because of ambushes and landmines. And I hadn't understood that that was the reasoning behind leaving my younger sister and I with a neighbor one fateful January morning when I was left to keep an eye on my little sister and she drowned. And this was just so heartbreaking. Dad had said, it wasn't that your mother didn't want to protect you, it's just there was so much to protect you from. It just hadn't occurred to her that somebody could drown in a duck pond. And I think that is one of the things about war, is that the common or garden accidents that you have the luxury to look out for when you're not literally under the gun, those seep away from your attention.
We do, in the book, end up back at the tree of forgetfulness, the banana and fish farm that your parents now live on and presumably will live out their days. There's a passage I'd like you to read that really gets to the beauty of Africa and how they see Africa.
The evenings out here on the north bank of the Zambezi River are tremulously beautiful. A shaky ribbon of blue smoke from a nearby village's cooking fire hangs over the farm. Emerald-spotted doves are calling, my mother is dead, my father is dead, my relatives are dead, and my heart goes dum, dum, dum. Frogs are bellowing from the causeway, the air boils with beetles and cicadas, mosquitoes and tsetse flies. Egrets, white against the grey-pink sky, are floating upriver to roost in the winterthorn trees in the middle of Dad's bananas. I won't let him chop down those trees, Mum says. The birds love them.
That's Alexandra Fuller reading from her new memoir, Cocktail Hour Under the Tree of Forgetfulness. You can hear how her charming mother responded to this book and the first memoir at our website, npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm David Green. Oklahoma is only one of several states experiencing drought conditions. Water is being recycled in many places for use in parks and gardens. But there's one type of water reuse that is still hard for people to accept. NPR's Elise Spiegel explains.
Brent Haddad is a professor of environmental studies who researches water in a place where water is often in short supply. He works in California, UC Santa Cruz.
There's just an issue of, well, where are we going to get the next gallon of water? New water supplies are needed.
Now, in the late 90s, Haddad started getting really interested in water reuse. At the time, a number of local water agencies in the West were proposing to build plants which would clean local wastewater so that it could be reused for drinking water. But, says Haddad, these proposals were consistently shot down.
The public wasn't really examining the science involved. They were just saying no. And the water agencies felt that these responses were irrational. And that's what I would hear at these water agency meetings, these very frustrated water engineers saying, my public is irrational. They're irrational. They simply won't listen.
For those of you who don't know, the water reuse we're talking about is when water that's been used in your toilet, your shower, is cleaned through a variety of technological processes that make it so clean you can drink it. And then it's reused in the same location to water fields, to put in reservoirs for drinking water. Now, from the perspective of the water engineers Haddad was meeting, reuse was a no-brainer. The science indicated that the water cleaned this way could be made safe. Clean Water Action, an environmental activist group, also supports reuse for drinking water, though they think that there should be national regulatory standards. But according to Brent Haddad, no matter what the scientists or environmental organizations said, the public saw it differently. Former sewage water was gross.
A scientific answer is not going to satisfy someone who's feeling revulsion. You have to approach it in a different way.
And so Haddad got funding from a nonprofit called the Water Reuse Foundation to do a study that might untangle what exactly was behind the public's revulsion. He knew just who he wanted to help him with this research. This was a job, he concluded, for psychologists.
I'm Carol Nemiroff. I am trained as a psychologist.
Carol Nemiroff is a professor at the University of Southern Maine. And though she had no experience with water per se, she did have experience with the issue of psychological contagion. For a living, she researches the habit we all have of thinking that once something has had contact with another thing, their parts are in some way joined.
It's a very broad feature of human thinking. Everywhere we look, you see contagion thinking.
Now, to be clear, contagion thinking isn't always negative. For example,
if I have my grandmother's ring versus an exact replica of my grandmother's actual ring is better because she was in contact with it, she wore it, it's her real, actual, true ring. So we act like objects are, their history is part of objects, and their history of contact is particularly potent.
And, says Nemiroff, there are very good reasons why people think like this.
As a basic rule of thumb for making decisions when we're uncertain about realities in the world, this has probably served us very well.
Still, Nemiroff and Haddad wanted to figure out more about our beliefs about contagion in water. And so, together with two other psychologists, they recruited over 2,000 people and gave them a series of very fine-grained questionnaires. The questionnaires sought to break down exactly what you would have to do to wastewater to make it acceptable to people to drink. Here's what their research found.
It is quite difficult to get the psychological, the cognitive sewage out of the water, even after the real sewage is gone.
Around 60% of people are unwilling to drink water that has had direct contact with sewage. And Nemiroff will point out that from the perspective of a water engineer, there is a certain irony to this. After all, looked at in a certain way, we are all kind of drinking water that has at one point been sewage. You know.
We are all downstream of somebody else. Absolutely. And even the nice, fresh, pure spring water, you know, fish and birds poop in it. So there is no water that has not been pooped in somewhere. And I hope I didn't just freak out a whole bunch of people.
But since she knows that people are usually freaked out by this, she says you have to make a fundamental change so that people see the water differently.
You have to change the identity of it so it's not the same water. It's an identity issue, not a contents issue. And so you have to break that perception. The water you're drinking has to not be the same water in your mind as that raw sewage was going in.
The best way to do that, says Nemiroff, is to have people cognitively co-mingle the water with nature.
We had them imagine the water going into an underground aquifer and sitting there for either 1 year or 10 years. And we find that sitting in an underground aquifer for 10 years is actually helpful. It budges even those unwilling folks.
This, says Brent Haddad, is why people often find it acceptable to get their water supply from their local river, even though it was once part of the sewage of the town upstream, because they see river water as natural. But in fact, Haddad says, putting treated water back into nature might actually make it dirty again.
Well, that's an interesting twist to all this, is that in fact, when you do introduce a river or even groundwater, holding water in the ground, you run the risk of deteriorating the water that's been treated. It might actually make the water quality worse.
Then reused water has to be cleaned a second time. So you see, our psychological relationship to water and our beliefs about contagion have an enormous impact on water policy in this country. We spend millions and millions of dollars. Consider what we spend on bottled water alone for water that is cognitively free of contamination. Elise Spiegel, NPR News, Washington.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Alyssa Block. The news of the world is back in the news, along with the Murdoch family. That's because of documents released today by a British parliamentary committee. They contain charges that phone hacking was widespread and well-known at the highest levels of the now-closed tabloid, and the documents challenge the testimony of James Murdoch, the son of Rupert, and strongly suggest there was a cover-up. NPR's David Folkenflik reports.
British newspaper executives for News Corp now take responsibility for the phone hacking and police corruption scandal, but they have maintained they did not know about those illegal actions until recently. 4 years ago, in a document only made public today, Clive Goodman said otherwise. Goodman was the Royals editor for the News of the World. In 2007, he and a private investigator for the tabloid were convicted and given jail sentences for hacking into the phones of members of the royal family. Goodman was fired, but wrote to a top executive to object. Conservative MP John Whittingdale is chairman of the parliamentary committee.
And in that letter, he says the reason why he is appealing is because other members of staff were carrying out the same illegal procedures. And he then goes on to say this practice was widely discussed in the daily editorial conference until explicit reference to it was banned by the editor. Now, that is a pretty extraordinary claim.
That editor, Andrew Coulson, resigned but became a top aide to Prime Minister David Cameron. Goodman went on to write that the tabloid's top lawyer, Tom Crone, and Coulson, quote, promised on many occasions that I could come back to a job at the newspaper if I did not implicate the paper or any of its staff in my mitigation plea. I did not, and I expect the paper to honor its promise to me. Documents reveal Goodman was paid roughly $400,000 in severance and fees that year, though Les Hinton, then a top executive, told him he was owed nothing. Labour MP Tom Watson, another member of the committee, told Sky News the implications were stark.
If Clive Goodman's letter is accurate, the whole foundation of the company's defence for the last 3 years collapses. And it also shows that Andy Coulson's previous evidence was misleading to Parliament.
Coulson and a parade of News Corp officials testified that they believed Goodman had been a rogue reporter. James Murdoch is the company's top executive in Europe. He told the parliamentary inquiry he did not know hacking was widespread until last year, even though he had approved payment of £1 million for a secret settlement of just such a complaint against News of the World 2 years earlier. Murdoch also said he hadn't known of a crucial memo which showed other reporters had been involved in phone hacking. But lawyer Tom Crone said he shared that email with Murdoch in approving the settlement. Murdoch also told Parliament the company relied on an outside review by a law firm to say hacking had been an isolated case.
It's my understanding that that is what Harbottle and Lewis were helping to deal with, and that that opinion did satisfy the company at the time when the company rested on that opinion for a period of time.
His father, Rupert Murdoch, told the Wall Street Journal that the law firm made, quote, a major mistake. But the law firm is now firing back, saying it had only received limited access to emails and had been narrowly asked whether those emails could be used to prove Goodman's claims. Conservative MP Louise Mensch tells NPR she finds the memo from the law firm more damning than Goodman's original letter.
It would appear that Harbottle and Lewis rejected attempts by the company to get them to give a blanket clearance, a blanket sort of exculpatory note, and they wouldn't say that there was no reasonable evidence that Mr. Goodman's claims were true. They would only say that Mr. Goodman's claims weren't proven, which is a big difference.
The committee is calling several former British News Corp executives and editors to revisit their testimony next month. Whittingdale said James Murdoch is likely to follow. David Folkenflik, NPR News.